Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge. We're going to begin with our nutshell of the day. It's a Tom and Alan co-production. Making comfort a priority will make you eventually very uncomfortable, which is another one of those paradoxes we love and hate so much in the rooms of recovery.
For that to be too high a priority, you know, is really actually will affect our value system. So basically that becomes an avoidant value system.
One of my friends is a Catholic, and he was using the analogy of the weight room and, you know, taking the heavy weight. And he's like, you got to tear that flesh. You got to tear that flesh in order to, you know, get to that next level of strength. You know, I mean, me currently, I'm rebuilding my leg after significant injury. And my physical therapist said that he's got a weight goal for the squat that I need to get to. And he said, as soon as you can squat your body weight, you'll be able to do most of the things that, you know, have been eluding you to this point. But it's a significant, you know, it's a significant jump from like what I can do currently. And so when I'm in the gym, you know, and I'm like over at the weight rack and I'm just like thinking about that pain, you know, that I'm going to have when I, you know, add stuff to the rack. But I know that like therein is my progress, is like I need to be building capacity. I need to do it in a controlled and, you know, like a responsible way. But I will not rise to that next level of capacity that I need to get to unless I'm willing to undergo that pain.
We know people who work out and stuff like that, and they can hurt themselves because they just value the pain so much. They've got pain for pain's sake. What you're talking about is a very reasonable, rational way that your doctor is working with you, or your physical therapist is working with you, saying, here's what we're going to do. There's going to be some pain or discomfort. This is the reason, you know. And so your motivation is clear. I'm not doing this because I want to be uncomfortable. I'm not doing, because a lot of us is codependence. We have to be careful about that, because we have been attracted to just being uncomfortable. I can say that for myself. It's like, or being in pain. So it's like, I'm doing this because this is the direction I'm going. And that's a really good example of that in terms of, you know, your knee that was destroyed when you fell off a mountain.
You know, what it reminds me of, Patrick, is the importance of value of balance, right? The value of balance in our life. Mm. What Tom is bringing up, an important thing, is to not label anything as good or bad, and just to see it as, what value does it have? Because being comfortable has value at times. You know, if I push myself, I also need time to be able to step back and integrate the experience I've had and to grow from it. And so growth is this modulation, if you will, between taking a risk, pushing the boundaries, pushing the envelope, stepping back, integrating what I've done, being able to sit and be, you know, calm, comfortable, whatever you want to call it. And then moving again in this undulation between experiencing, mm-hmm. pushing myself, and then getting back and, you know, assimilating, you know, the experience I've just had. Mm-hmm. That's how we grow in life. See, that's the way we grow. Now, my obsession, especially when I was younger, is I just want to feel good all the time. So that means I want to be comfortable. So what does that mean? So then I start to drink to feel okay. Mm-hmm. Or I start to use drugs to feel okay. I don't want to push that other thing and look at my insecurity, look at the things that are making me uncomfortable. But that's the stuff I avoided, as Tom was saying. See, so when I have an avoidance of that, I mm-hmm. free my growth. Yeah. It's impossible to mature. And see, these are some of the things that we do on a personal level that interfere with maturity. Yes, our culture also is stuck in many ways, but we're stuck too in terms of our relationship to our experience.
Right.
And that's why.
And that's where we have to start always.
Always our relationship to our experience. Tom was talking about that in the beginning. If my experience defines me instead of my relationship to it, I'm in trouble. You know, it's this whole thing is that we want to claim our experience. We don't want it to claim us, or else we become victims of it.
I am not my fear. I am not my judgment. I am not, you know, I am not my addiction. You know, it's like that's why we spend so much time with that stuff that you talk about, Alan, with the differentiation on the front end. It's like, what's really weird is that once you get to see if this is your experience, once you help somebody differentiate between themselves and all of these culprits or all these things that are not them, it's like sometimes people get confused with me because I stop asking them about all that stuff, because once we clearly know who you are, that's who I'm talking to.
It gets wild with this paradox of comfort and maturity, because we need to learn to take care of ourselves all over again. Like, we never learned this like concept of self-care. You know, comfort as it's using comfort as it's intended, which is, you know, like a necessary respite from, you know, all of the other responsible items, you know, we need to take on any given day. For somebody like me who does, you know, I'm an addict. And so, you know, I'm attracted to extremes. Yet self-care can get a little dicey.
See, we have to be self-supporting. And part of that includes self-care. Some of it to support myself means or pushing myself, right? And going beyond my comfort level. So self-support embodies or embraces, it's like an umbrella. It involves all of the things I need to do to grow myself into the person I can be, to let my life force continue to move forward. See, that's the issue, is that when I'm stuck, I'm not moving forward, and we don't do well stuck.
Beware of the pursuit of comfort. So much stuff just involved in that little piece.
This is from Michael Root. I love Michael Root. He had a birthday recently. Mm-hmm. When a lot of us get into the rooms, we immediately pursue material success and material advancement. And what he said was, and I like the particular way he said it, he says, I think it's important that you all get those things and you go after it so that you can realize sooner rather than later that that's not enough. That's not going to fill you up. That's not the game, in a sense. But, you know, you need to get it to realize that it's, you know, that's not really the thing that you're seeking. And so I thought that was,
You got to get there yourself. Yeah. I love it.
All right. So I love Joe's Beyond Belief book. I thought I would read the daily reflection for today. He begins with a quote by Arthur Schopenhauer. All truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. Third, it is accepted as being self-evident. How did those of us who were confronted about our addictions respond to the suggestion that we were powerless and our lives were unmanageable? What a joke might have been a knee-jerk reaction. The best defense was a good offense. A dismissive or hostile reaction to an inconvenient truth is something we call denial, a cliche of our addictive past. And now we identify as addicts as if it was obvious. The truth of addiction passes through these three stages. Even in recovery, coming to terms with a new truth is a great challenge. Our innate confirmation biases render us way more likely to argue that we are right than to welcome a new way of looking at things. Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber, who look at the evolution of human reasoning, illustrate for us how the open mind we associate with the spiritual life has some social and psychological booby traps. We tend to pick and choose from a wealth of evidence that defends our current prejudices, and we easily dismiss convincing evidence that contradicts our point of view. Political and religious agendas can withstand damning contradictory evidence. A fellowship can wallow in reification when needed change looms. Consumers can minimize their impact on a global crisis. If a breakthrough can be made, the truth feels obvious. Maybe we find the routine and rituals of a meeting comforting now. What was our first impression of meetings? Did we see them as infantile or cult-like? Did we say to ourselves, no way in hell am I joining this whack job outfit? What are things I scoff or balk at? What are things I feel hostile toward? Maybe I am two-thirds of the way to a breakthrough. Whack job outfit. It sounds like something James Caan would say.
Well, that sounds like something Joe would say. I just think. Well, because I mean, we actually, you know, because the three of us, you know, among millions of others, we quite proud of being a part of this whack job outfit.
Well, coming to terms with a new truth. I mean, just a very like simplistic, but like it's sitting right there. Example I can think of is the Plain Language Big Book, which like, you know, Joe spoke to the benefit of that beautifully when he was on, you know, earlier this year, where like there's a lot of people walking through the doors trying to get sober who were really able to get their head around, you know, like some of the message of the Big Book, just as a consequence of this new literature being introduced. But it's there's some institutionalists, you know, that got sober with the earlier text that really like violently, you know, disagree with, you know, the introducing, you know, kind of a new strain into this project.
I have a quote at the top of my Facebook page that I just love from Christopher Reeve, and it parallels this. It's not the same, but it parallels. He says, "At first something seems impossible, then it becomes improbable, but with enough conviction and support, it finally becomes inevitable." I have that up there because I want to read it on a regular basis. I love that. And but see, all this stuff has in common is, you know, for us not to do, as we have in the past, stop with first impressions. You know, whack job outfit. Okay, that's my first impression. Let's look a little closer.
I think a good refrain, especially when you're talking about like the cult of AA, you know, just to use one example, just start with, yeah, it is a cult. Sure, it's a cult. So what, you know, how do we proceed? What can I get out of this?
You know, people do call it that. But before we do, you know, let me tie what you read about the different levels of truth, right? Or yeah. Really, you're describing more the experience we have with reality. See, instead of calling it truth, just think about all those three stages, even what Tom was saying. We're talking about an experience with reality. And we know that emotional sobriety is based on having an appropriate and honest relationship to reality. Right? So when I am, you know, denying the truth of my existence, I worked with a gentleman this morning. He has so much trouble accepting to his innermost self he's alcoholic. And guess what happens? He thinks that there'll come a day when I can drink, and he goes out and drinks. And what do you think happens? Eventually he loses control and he blows up his life. And then he's into this thing, but my God, I should have known better. No, because you didn't deal with and accept the fact of the truth of your life, because for you, being an alcoholic is something to be ashamed of. And instead of owning it, it ends up making you do things that you're ashamed of. I mean, see, it's always that thing is, man, if I'm afraid of looking stupid, I'm going to act stupid. I swear to God, yeah. That just seems to be a truth. So what we really are telling people with this is that the more you can get aligned with reality, which is your truth, what the truth of your existence, which means accepting our limitations, which is not an easy thing to do in this culture we live in. It's all about this can do. If you put your mind to it, you should be able to do anything.
Right. So much judgment. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much judgment, but it's not true. You know, I can put my mind to wanting to fly. And if I jump off a roof and defy reality, what's going to happen? I'm going to break my damn neck as I jump off and flap my arms because I think I can fly. Mm-hmm. See, that's this misalignment with reality. And if you look to every trouble you have, it's because you have an expectation that misaligns you with the reality of the condition you're dealing with. So the misalignment is the big issue here. And that's what Tom was saying, that we go through these different stages. It's the same thing that happens. I fight reality and reality wins. And if I learn from my experience, eventually I can become better aligned with reality. But if I continue to be oppositional and defiant, I'm going to keep doing the same thing and expecting better results. And it's not going to happen.
Right. Well, yeah. And let it go back to your client you were talking about this morning. It's like, because this to me, this is always say, this is why I turns out the universe knew what they was doing with by making me an English major instead of a psychology person. It's like, but I should have known better. It's like immediately. And it's so fun to do this stuff. But it's so simple, but it's amazing. Change that. I would say if we were sitting in the room and I got change that. Now I know better.
See, that's it.
It's a success. It's not like you're saying the same thing, but the judgment is you know, the one's an affirmation. Now I know better.
And that's the alignment with reality. See, now I know better. Now I integrate that. Now I learn from this. I don't need to cause this kind of trouble in my life anymore because I'm learning who I am.
Lesson learned, Dean.
Learned. I'm now learning to respect myself and accept who I am without having all these ideas that I should be more than myself to be okay.
And have self-esteem based on the fact that, you know, we get to choose our sources of self-esteem. That self-esteem based on the fact that I'm learning, not that I should have known or I do know. Because to me, I think if we base, that's one of my best insights as far as I know in my life so far, is if I base my self-esteem on being a person who learns something on a daily basis, a day that I fuck up entirely can be a successful day according to that definition, because there's lots to learn.
Right on.
A successful day is not a happy day. It's like, I love happy days. I love happy days. But that's not the point.
I relate so much to that client. I ran into somebody at the gym a few weeks ago who was my coworker at the job that I bombed out of because of my using. It's the last corporate job I had. And he was the one who would carpool with me in the morning. He would come and pick me up, and I would sometimes be drunk or I'd be on pills, and he would look at me and he'd be like, you know, Patrick, you know, you can't go into work like this. Like, what are you doing? And I was so grateful that I had an opportunity to make an amends to him just running into him in public. And I think the first words I said to him were, 7 years. You know, Craig, great to see you. And he looked at me. He looked at me and he just like laughed, and we hugged each other, and he's just like, God, has it been 7 years? Because he's still at the same job. So for him, time has just proceeded in a very kind of, you know, normal linear way. And for me, all this stuff's, you know, a lot of internal changes, I hope. But
a time for amends, but also just celebration.
Well, yeah. And like what that made me think of when you said that, Alan, was that like I have the same illness now as I did when I was seeing him on a regular basis. But my relationship to it is completely different. When I had it back in the day, I was denying that it existed. And I was, I was an active addiction and I was trying to hide it. And I was basically like, I was living in that misalignment you spoke to, where I just, I thought I was coping with this thing and not fully owning it and not treating it, obviously. I mean, I was treating it in a way, but not in a productive or healthy way.
And well, not in a way that you were aligned to the reality of it. See, that's the issue, right?
Right. But now it's, so I'm still an addict, and you know, I still have, you know, I carry it with me, but like it could not be more different, my relationship to it now.
No, that's perfect.
And as a result, I'm able to hug that guy, and I'd like to think, you know, maybe I'll see him again, and maybe, you know, he'll feel differently about me, and you know,
but that's not the point.
Of course,
how he feels about you. But the other thing is, I'm just taking good notes today. We first deny it, and then we want to exorcise it. Once we realize we have a problem, please make it go away. That's the language we show up for therapy with, whether it be alcoholism or anything else. Make it go away. And then now you're perfect. You're a perfect example. Now it's still there. It's exactly as it was. The thing is, nothing's changed about my addiction. Nothing's changed about your addiction. We're changed. And now, because of how we've changed, it's part of our strength. It's not just, oh, I got to put up with this. It's like, no. I mean, basically, it's like Michael J. Fox said in his first book, is if somebody had come to him, you know, down the road and said, I'll take away your Parkinson's, he said, no. He said, because so much has come, I've gained so much from this. I've learned so much. I've been able to do so much because of this. And that's who we are with our process, our recovery, our addiction. Are you sorry you're an addict? Hell no. You know, I'm proud of what I've been able to do with it. I'm grateful for what I've been able to do with it. And I love sharing it with other people who are doing the same thing.
And that does come, you know, and I didn't think it would. And I didn't understand when people talked about their gratitude.
But it does. Yeah, That's a good thing for us. Just to echo to the, anybody who needs to hear that listening. If it doesn't feel like it's even a possibility, you know, to the best of your ability, trust us, it is, and it will happen if you keep moving.
The other thing I was going to say is I love what you talked about in terms of success, Tom. It reminded me of John Wooden's idea when he brought new players onto his team at UCLA. He said, I want to redefine success for you guys. I want you to understand that success has to do with your effort, not the outcome. And I want you guys to focus on what you can control, which is how you show up and your attitude and your effort when you're playing. He says, if you come out there and you play the best for me and you have a great attitude about the team and you're all a part of it, we were successful. And it doesn't matter what the numbers were up on the clock. If we do that, then we are winners. And he built that into them. And you're right on. If I start to look at success in terms of how I'm showing up in my effort, then we got it, man. We got it. So podcast today. Next week I'm going to be in Paris, you guys. I'm taking Maddie and Cece over there. So I won't be here for the podcast next week. So you guys decide if you do that or not. But I want to wish everyone that's listening to us a happy holiday. And as Tom said, success has nothing to do with whether you're happy or not. It's how you meet the experience you're having. And we can feel good about ourselves even when we're sad, disappointed, you know, when our hearts are broken, by focusing on how we deal with it, not what's happening.